But joining me now, ready and waiting on the show, is our guest for today. He is a man who we love to stop into and talk all things Premier League football. And I tell you what, this guy is perfect for talking about an area of the world that we haven't spoken about in a while, the Northeast. Mr. Christian Hennage joining us on the line now. Christian, mate, how are you? How is the summer treating you first and foremost? Been a long time since we checked in with you.
It is. The summer has been treating me lovely. There's been lots of business to peruse over and hopefully still more to come.
And out in the US, I've got to ask you this before we get into the English football. How much have you been gripped? Have you been taken at all by any of the Gold Cup action that's taking place at the moment?
I have, yeah. I managed to catch the US's demolition of El Salvador at the weekend. That was a fairly interesting affair. I thought it perhaps weren't as clinical as they could have been, but it was a passionate affair. I think that's one way to put it. There was coming down the road into Baltimore, and you could see all the El Salvadorian fans with flags outside the cars and all that kind of crazy stuff.
It's definitely something that I think is slowly gripping the US in general, especially with the semi-finals and the final now upon us. We need to talk, though, about all things this side of the Atlantic and talk about a little bit of English football. Now, you're a man for Northeast football. We all know that here at World Football Daily. What have you made of the bombardment of players coming into Sunderland this summer? Is Di Canio changing too much too quickly, or is this going to be a season where Sunderland really start to just bounce back from that torrid year they had last year?
I don't think he had much of a choice. They finished the season well under his tenure, but overall there were still some scars from the Martin O'Neill era. There was a lot of players there who I think were committed or needing to do what they should be, and accordingly changes had to be made, and those changes so far have been very sweeping. I mean, today it's come out that Lee Catamount's now training with the youth side and he's been stripped of his number. That, you would think, indicates he's likely to leave the club soon. And yeah, there have been, you know, 8 first team players arrive, 9 if you include young Duncan Watmore in there as well. But it, as I said, it had to be done, the changes had to be made. And so far, they've seemed to bring a good start, at least with that victory over Tottenham in the Peace Cup.
Yeah, a very impressive victory over Spurs indeed. But we've been asking a number of our pundits this, how much do you take these friendly results with that pinch of salt, and you don't really look at the results and look at more maybe about the moments of cohesion that these sides can produce together? Because a lot of this is about fitness, the pre-season, isn't it?
Exactly, and I think it depends what you try and ascertain from these games. I think if there's things you can possibly guarantee yourself with, it's that Sunderland will be an incredibly fit side this season. They'll be a side that's well-drilled, well-organised, and more importantly, can go right until the final whistle, which I think was an issue for them last year. Martin O'Neill was someone who, after he left, it was, you know, lamented quite often that he didn't do fitness work, that they didn't give that consideration to tactics. Canio is very much the polar opposite of that. As Alfred and Dye said when he first joined the club, you know, we do a lot more work on tactics. And he was kind of keen not to, denigrate Martin O'Neill too much, but you could see what he was intimating from his comments.
And Di Canio tried to maybe bring in not more flair, but certainly a little more panache, I think, to this Sunderland side. And some of his signings will show that. Do you see the Northeast, you know, traditionally considered, you know, a bit of a rough area sometimes, and the footballers sometimes replicated that. You look at someone like Lee Catamount. Do you see Sunderland being able to come out and make more of a kind of panache to their start to the Premier League season?
Well, I think if there was one criticism that fans often lamented the side was last year, it was that they didn't have much excitement in them. There wasn't much of that flair that you talk about. I think that the Canio is someone who, again, doesn't like what he calls tippy-tappy football, which is kind of what Swansea and Barcelona and sides like that play, where it's possession-based. For him, it's about being direct and playing essentially 4-4-2, and the defensive stability you get comes from your organisation and working together as a team. The players he signed so far, there's only really Emmanuel Giaccherini, who I would argue brings the kind of quality you're talking about. A little bit of pace, a little bit of trickery, perhaps not the most consistent in terms of his delivery of final product, but still, he gives them a supplement to the likes of Adam Johnson and Stephen Sessegnon, which for the final few weeks of the season, if they weren't creating anything, truth be told, Sunderland weren't creating anything. And when you limit yourself to such few players with that potential, then it kind of makes you easier to defend against and easier to stop. And he needed those options. And I think, yeah, he can definitely breed a direct but not long style that is exciting, creative, but again, gets quick results and doesn't necessarily need to be passed around the box for, you know, 20, 30 minutes of a 90-minute match.
Arsenal style, if you will, there, Kristen. And what about finally Jose Altidore, just with Sunderland as well? We saw them struggle in front of goals plenty of times last season. Altidore, proven striker in Holland, but not done it yet in England, of course. Hasn't had the chance to, really. But for Altidore, how big a move is this? And can he be that go-to guy for goals, do you think, considering the confidence he should have garnered for himself out in Holland?
Well, it's the, you know, the Alphonso Alves, the Teo Kjesven paradox, isn't it? How valuable are goals in Holland? And how, you know, transferable are they, perhaps? I think it's a very big move for him because it's a big opportunity and it's a chance for him to prove a lot of detractors wrong, not just in the Premier League, but those who think that really Holland and that sort of league, without wanting to be too patronising to it, is his level. I think he can get the goals. I really do. I think he's got the potential to do so. He also has the benefit now, I would argue, when you compare it to Hull. He's playing with better players. I think he's playing in a system that's more conducive to his talent. He's obviously matured. He said quite openly, you know, I've become more mentally mature. I've developed physically, even technically, and tactically as well. He said, I've learned how to play with wingers. His coach at AZ, Verbeek, spent a lot of time working with him. And, he thanked him a lot for that. And I could very easily see him having a similarly close relationship with Paolo Di Canio, because I think that's what Di Canio likes. He likes this idea of a one-on-one relationship with his players and investing in them, provided they invest in what he wants to do. And it's the other possible beneficial factor in this move for him is that Stephen Fletcher will still have the burden of the goals. He'll be missing for perhaps a few more weeks, but again, he's the sole threat, shall we say. He's the one who the pressure is put on to score because they've seen him score. I think Josie can almost fly under the radar for a few months just while he gets used to things, gets adjusted. And I think he'll be given the chances to score. It falls down to whether he scores them, and I think ultimately he will.
Now, moving across to the other obviously big side in the northeast, Newcastle United, and really after the summer that they had with this Joe Kinnear appointment as the director of football and all of the fallout from that, it's been very quiet in the last week or so, really. It's been good to kind of maybe settle the ship for them after everything that happened in the early part of the summer, but very little movement in the transfer window again. Do you see this being a problem at the moment for Newcastle?
I do. There's unfortunate deja vu in relation to last summer when Vernon Anita was the only real player of note to come in. Again, it's that crossroads of they need to invest. If they don't invest, then there's potential they could go backwards. The club were quite overt in stating in January that the players they signed in January, a lot of those players had been planned for the summer and the deals had been brought forward in a bid to curtail any threat of relegation. That doesn't really, you know, satisfy the fans who are disappointed at the lack of options they've got specifically up front. The Papi Cisse situation is incredibly difficult and convoluted, and without him, it only really leaves Shola Ameobi up there, who, for all his effort and his, you know, desire to be at the club, he just isn't a leading striker. He's someone you're going to bring off the bench, and the perhaps stagnated moves through the likes of Darren Bent, you see like Remy mentioned, Patrick Gomi, there needs to be some kind of movement, because at the minute they need at least a striker, I would argue a left winger to boot. And defensive cover wouldn't be the worst thing, because the problem is they've lost players as well. Steve Harper, Danny Simpson, James Perch, they've all departed. And at times the squad did look a little bit threadbare when it had bad injuries. And it's simply not good enough to say we've had injuries. That doesn't stop you being relegated if you're down that position near the end of the season.
You mentioned, of course, the Papi Cisse problem that continues up at Newcastle. We're still no closer, from what I can tell from the papers here, to a resolution to this. Do Newcastle need to maybe do what we've seen happen in Spain before, where they just give Cisse a shirt without that sponsor's logo on it, or are they going to have to move Cisse on? Because it doesn't seem like he's going to back down from this at all.
You're right, and as I said, it's a convoluted issue. The latest development is that he's been pictured in a casino, and there's a feeling amongst a certain section of the fan base that that in itself is hypocrisy, because you can't claim to object to Wonga on religious grounds if you also don't follow the rest of the rulings. And there are then further, you know, delvings into the belief that he shouldn't have won a Virgin Money sponsor, because that again contradicts his religion. Mm. I think you have to form a separation between religion and belief. It's his right as an individual to object to wearing Wonga. I think if you try and attribute religion to it, you start to muddy the issue somewhat. He's entitled to that right. From what I understand, he would be willing to wear a shirt without a sponsor or a replace sponsor. There have been some fairly admirable suggestions to Sir Bobby Robson's cancer charity, perhaps as a replacement. The issue seems to stem from the fact that Wonga are unwilling to have that as an option, and neither the club, and things are becoming a little bit strained. If you have to move him on, I think the one blessing is that you'll get a decent fee for him, because he's proved that, given the service, he can be quite a potent striker. The issue then that surfaces, though, is that you've further hampered your own squad. You've lost probably your best striker from last season, if you excuse Denver Barr, who left mid-season. And it now leaves you, as I said, with Jeff Scholler, Amiobi as a first recognised striker. And then it puts more pressure on you to sign those strikers. And I would argue it gives a significant advantage to the clubs you're negotiating with, because they're fully aware of the predicament that you put yourself in.
Just to play devil's advocate here, though, then, Christian, I mean, if it's his right to say, I don't want to wear Wonga, doesn't that open the door for all sorts of controversy if you don't put a religious backing to it? Because you could have, for instance, you could say Lionel Messi at Barcelona say, I don't want to wear a Barcelona shirt that's made by Nike. I want it to be made by Adidas. I don't want to have the Nike logo on my Barcelona shirt. Why? Because it's my right to say that I won't wear that shirt. I mean, you could get into, I know that's taking it maybe a step further and maybe to the extreme, but you could get into some sort of argument like that where players' individual sponsorships start to affect that rather than giving it a religious backing.
I see the point you're making. I think that the difference would be is that with Wonga, they are a payday loan company. And by that, I mean that the APR rate they charge is, I believe, around 2,500%. And the belief amongst some financial experts and such like is that it's a very irresponsible way to live, because these people can get caught into a cycle where they're living on these payday loans. So there is, I would argue, far more of a perhaps moral objection in something like Wonga as opposed to Nike, because admittedly, Nike have a questionable history themselves with that kind of controversy of, sweatshops and such like. Mm. But I think the prevalent issue is that he doesn't feel it's right. And whether that is formed from with that kind of controversy of, sweatshops and such like. Mm. But I think the prevalent issue is that he doesn't feel it's right. And whether that is formed from his religious upbringing that, you know, loaning money and such like is not, or charging interest, sorry, on a loan is not right. Controversy of, sweatshops and such like. Mm. But I think the prevalent issue is that he doesn't feel it's right. And whether that is formed from his religious upbringing that, you know, loaning money and such like is not, or charging interest, sorry, on a loan is not right. That's his decision. I think you can't really dictate to someone how they operate religiously. Religion, much like politics and such like, is open to interpretation, and it depends how you interpret it yourself. What you consider conservatism might not be what I consider, you know, conservatism and such like. So, again, as I said, it's a very convoluted issue, and I think it's important that any club that finds itself in this situation operates with, you know, compassion, empathy, and approaches it in a fairly diplomatic and considered way, just because that's the way it should be done, not because you feel an obligation to.
Now, Christian, let's move away from the North East. There's one last side I want to talk to you quickly about. It's Tottenham Hotspur. I don't want to talk about Gareth Bale, though, amazingly. I know everybody seems to want to talk about that move, potential move to Real Madrid all the time at the moment. I want to talk about this move for Soldado, the Valencia striker. Tottenham putting in a bid of $22 million, having it rejected. Valencia saying they want something in the region of $25, $26 million. If you were Daniel Levy, you understand how much you need a top-quality striker still at Tottenham to almost complete the set for the summer. Would you not be willing, in the grand scheme of things, that extra $4 million isn't going to be too much if someone's got goals like Soldado's goals could get you into the Champions League next year? Should Levy just be wrapping this deal up as quickly as possible and not leaving it to the last minute, as Tottenham seem to do on so many occasions in these transfer windows?
Yeah, I can see the temptation to do that. But I think keeping your powder dry is probably a wise idea. The benefit that Tottenham have is there are perhaps a few fringe players in there that they're maybe looking to move on. Tom Huddleston, funnily enough, for Sunderland is one. I know Danny Rose has been mentioned, but Villas-Boas seems actually quite keen to keep him after watching him at Sunderland. And there are a few others, maybe even Andros Townsend, if they wanted to, that they could cash in and make up the difference on. The concern is that I can't think of a wealth of targets that they could opt for instead. I mean, Kevin Gamero is all but a severe player now. I think he would have been a lesser financially in terms of an option for them, and perhaps would have given them the same kind of quality. It's just finding those other targets. It's very simple. It's supply and demand. It's what you're demanding and how much of a supply is there of strikers who could fit that mold, will fit the dynamic that you want to play. Because again, I think that's a mistake that teams make occasionally, is that they don't really see what kind of striker they're buying and does he fit in a 4-2-3-1 situation that Spurs seem to enjoy playing. Can he play in a 4-4-2 as well? How flexible is he tactically? How aware is he and how much service does he need? And it's for those reasons I think that maybe keep it a little bit longer. There are obviously other teams interested in there as well. But eventually you'll have to come to a decision. Either you meet the clause, you meet the valuation or you don't. And I think, yeah, it's probably a wise idea to meet that valuation, because for much of last season, Manuel Adebayor looked a completely different player. Mm. And I just don't feel that Jermaine Defoe was consistent enough for a top four side. A very good finisher who, you know, most weeks, or, you know, maybe 2 out of 4 weeks might get you a goal or two, but he's not going to go on a really brilliant run. He's someone who seems to score in big spates over a short period of time.
It's going to be interesting to see if Tottenham do up their ante in their search for a main striker. And Christian, when they do, and when more news starts coming through from English football, as it always does, we look forward to catching up with you throughout the pre-season and of course the season as well. Have a fantastic time, mate, in the rest of the time in the USA. If you can get out to the West Coast, I'm sure Rafa always has a pad open and for you to stay in, although I think he's moving house still, actually, so maybe he won't this one time be able to, but I'm sure he could offer you a tent on the beach or something like that, man. But we look forward to catching up with you very soon indeed, pal.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me, mate.
Thanks so much. Christian Hennage there joining us here on World Football Daily, talking all things English football, talking about the movers and the shakers in the Premier League market.